as the ice recedes, it might be possible to have commercial fisheries on those stocks.
A proposal to regulate Arctic fishing. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 26th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Homer author travels the world to unlock the mystery of talent.
Just like you can train to maximize your cardiovascular system, there's also a way to train and to sort of acquire skill at the highest velocity you can.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. 1-888-842-7848.
The state is fighting the season's first big wildfire in the interior. The Broken Snowshoe Fire is burning about 10 to 15 miles northeast of McGrath. Alaska Fire Service spokesman Doug Stockdale says the roughly 5,000-acre blaze is drawing considerable suppression resources.
We've got 86 folks on that one. We've had two large tankers, our Convair tankers that have gone over there, the state tankers, that have worked the flanks of the fire. As of last report, we had about 20 loads of retardant and some bucket work with a helicopter.
Stockdale says smoke from the fire is visible from McGrath, but the blaze is burning on the other side of the Kuskokwim River and is only threatening remote properties at this point. Another fire that's drawing attention is on the other side of the state in the eastern interior. Stockdale says the fire is burning near the Taylor Highway community of Chicken.
About 800 acres, and it was burning in boreal spruce and in an area close to where it burned in 2004. And because it's close to people and structures, we've put some crews on it. We have four Type 2 crews. Type 1 crew has been ordered. They've had we've asked for the state is actually managing that for us right now. And they have requested aerial support, retardant support from the Canadians.
Stockdale says another fire that's getting attention is burning west of the Parks Highway community of Anderson. He says 11 firefighters are on the half-acre blaze 4 miles west of the community. There are more than 20 fires listed as active in Alaska right now, but most are burning in remote country and are not being fought. The fires resulted from recent days' lightning. Despite fire officials' best efforts and the biggest wildfire on the Kenai Peninsula in 2 years, residents continue to violate the open burning suspension issued by the Alaska Division of Forestry. Over Memorial Day weekend, fire crews responded to a few small fires in the vicinity of the recently extinguished East End Road wildfire that burned more than 1,000 acres outside Homer earlier this month. Bill Hudo is an assistant fire management officer with the Division of Forestry. He says in a couple of cases, the fires were started by people burning yard debris in violation of the burning suspension.
People are not paying attention. They're burning when they want to, starting their own piles up. And they need to pay attention because if we end up coming to their residence and it catches on fire and catches more acreage on fire, they're the ones that's going to be end up being responsible for this. We've had every warning we can out. There's no burning right now because of the high fire danger.
Hudo says resources have been pulled off of the East End Road wildfire and directed to the interior. That means fewer firefighters are available to immediately battle a blaze that could flare up again at any time. A federal agency says it will open a public comment period on a proposal to prohibit commercial fishing in Arctic waters in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council adopted the plan in February. That plan is now open for public review. It will become final if the Secretary of Commerce approves it. The plan was hailed by environmentalists and industry representatives who say summertime melting of ice has increased interest in commercial fishing in the Arctic. David Balton is an ambassador of oceans and fisheries at the U.S. State Department. He was in Seward last week at the annual conference of the Center for Ocean and Law Policy, and he spoke about Arctic fishing. KDLL's Ben Stanton has the story.
Balton says little information is available about the status of fish in the Arctic Ocean and the specific behavior of those fish, but he says his department is considering what changes might be occurring.
There is some evidence that new populations or larger numbers of salmon are being found north of the Bering Strait than there were a generation ago. There is some possibility that larger populations of Arctic char may be occurring north of the Bering Strait, but it's all pretty anecdotal information at this point. We just don't know.
Balton says the theory is that as the water in oceans warms, fish that prefer certain temperatures will be moving north. Ultimately, that means the fish would cross the Bering Strait into the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas.
And as the ice recedes for longer periods of time, it might be possible to have commercial fisheries on those stocks. Currently, that's not happening, and at least in the U.S. EEZ north of the Arctic, it can't happen now. The North Pacific Council has adopted a plan that prevents the expansion of commercial fisheries, at least for now.
Currently, no large-scale commercial fishing operations are working in the U.S. north of the Bering Strait. Other areas of the Arctic do have commercial fishing.
There is a lot of large-scale commercial fishing on the other side of the Arctic, in the Barents Sea, in the part of the Arctic that borders the North Atlantic. So the Arctic is not really a single region when it comes to fisheries.
The Bering Sea is home to large fishing operations that have an international consideration. Balton says the U.S. and Russia have a complicated relationship with the shared resources across the boundary. The Fishery Council's approach has meant closing the U.S. Arctic areas to commercial fishing.
That's not the approach that our neighbors in the Arctic have taken, at least not yet. And so we're trying to persuade our neighbors to take a hard look at what's being done off Alaska and encourage them to do something comparable.
If the proposal is approved by the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, it would identify species likely to be sought by fisheries. The species include Arctic cod, saffron cod, and snow crab. The plan would not affect fisheries for salmon, whitefish, and shellfish. The proposal also would not affect Arctic subsistence fishing or hunting. It would apply to the United States waters only. Comments on the Arctic Fisheries Management Plan are due July 27. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
Six Southeast charter fishing businesses are suing to block new halibut catch restrictions. A top fisheries official says the lawsuit could lead to a reduction in the number of halibut that can be caught in Southeast waters. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Charter halibut operators are in court again, trying to keep the two fish per client per day bag limit that's been in place for years. They're fighting a one halibut limit set to take effect June 5th in Southeast Waters, the regulatory area known as 2C. The National Marine Fisheries Service imposed the limit to reduce the charter catch, which has gone over its allocation for several years. It's part of a years-old battle between charter operators and commercial fishermen.
The substance of the case really comes down to the fairness and equity of the allocation.
Attorney Earl Comstock represents Craig, Ketchikan, Juneau, and Sitka charter operators who filed the recent suit against federal regulators.
The National Marine Fisheries Service hasn't provided any explanation of why that's somehow a legitimate allocation. They simply start with the premise that the commercial fishermen are entitled to 87% of the fish, and therefore, if the guided anglers take more than 13%, there is a problem, and we don't share that view.
The suit is against the Federal Department of Commerce and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They're part of the complex regulatory system that determines how many halibut should be caught and who should catch them. The system has determined that halibut numbers are down, and it's meant reductions for some fishermen.
For years now, the commercial sector has taken cuts in their quota while the charter sector continues to harvest above its quota.
Peggy Parker is executive director of the Halibut Association of North America, a processors group. She and others in the industry back the one fish rule.
Unless something stops this over-harvesting that's being done in the charter sector, the commercial quota will continue to go down. And, you know, without exception, people in the commercial quota understand the reasons for the quota going down, and they accept it. They don't break the rules. Most people in the world don't break the rules. But the charter guys seem to think that the rules don't matter.
The one fish rule was proposed last year as a way to reduce the charter catch, which was double its allocation. Lodges and other charter operators sued, and federal rulemakers withdrew the limit. But the feds dropped their plans on a technicality before there was a ruling on the larger issue. They announced the one fish limit again earlier this month, which led to the new lawsuit. The overall catch is set by the International Pacific Halibut Commission, with allocation decisions made by the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. Commission Director Bruce Lehman says a legal victory by charter operators could lead to changes in the number of halibut available for all sectors of the fishery.
The commission would certainly regard that as a conservation issue because we've gone through some serious decreases in the commercial catch limits that have been recommended and accepted for that area. We certainly have seen some strong decreases in average age and proportion of older fish in all of Area 2, including Area 2C.
He expects commission staff would recommend changes. That's because of their concerns about the health of the halibut population in southeast waters. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, with the economy down, young Alaskans struggle to find summer jobs.
We have to say, oh God, the world sucks and we need a job because we're going to be living on the street.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com.
The Yukon River has completed its devastating breakup run. The coastal communities of Imonik and Alaganuk were the latest and final communities to experience Yukon flooding. For member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
Portions of Imonik spent 4 days underwater. Several homes were damaged, and the road to the airport was submerged under 6 feet of water. Now that the ice has cleared and the water has receded, the city of Imonik is trying to repair what they can. The airport and the village's fuel station are still without electricity after an ice chunk knocked down a telephone pole. Imonik's acting city manager, Martin Moore, says there will be no fuel sales and no plane travel until those electrical lines are repaired. Though breakup is now complete on the Yukon, the National Weather Service says that it could take some time for high water levels to drop. They say satellite images show 2 to 5 miles of hard, shore-fast ice. That will impede the flush out of Yukon ice. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Villages in flood-damaged areas of the state are now beginning the process of a presidential disaster declaration that will open more resources to help with repairs. Governor Palin over the weekend formally requested the federal disaster declaration. That follows the start of a preliminary assessment by federal emergency management teams at the end of last week. Jeremy Zedek of the state's Homeland Security Division says it's too early for a final damage assessment.
Until all flooding is resolved and we're able to get into each and every community, we won't have a full and accurate picture, and therefore it's difficult to determine if that presidential disaster declaration will be granted and what programs will be activated when it is.
Zedek says the state doesn't yet know what level of support the presidential disaster declaration will offer. The National Park Service has called off the search for a climber who has been missing on Denali for nearly a week. There has been no sign of Dr. Gerald Myers of Colorado or his gear during 6 days of air and ground searching. Myers set off for the summit on the morning of May 19th. He was sighted high on the mountain during the day, but did not return to camp that night. He was carrying minimal survival gear. In light of his limited supplies and the sub-zero temperatures, search managers say his survival is outside the window of possibility. Every summer, high school and college students across the nation flock to find work. But this year, many are discovering that scoring a decent job isn't easy. Alaska has been cushioned from much of the economic hardships faced in the lower 48. But some young Alaskans are finding that summer employment isn't quite as bountiful as it once was. APRN's Susanna Caldwell reports.
Seth Boyer is a pretty smart guy. a student at the University of Alaska Anchorage with a decent resume and plenty of work experience, Boyer thought finding a summer job would be simple. But this year, that wasn't the case. Despite applying to about 12 different places, largely higher-paying tourism jobs, he got no bites.
I apply to all these places. I go in, make nice, suit up, you know, fill out applications, hand in resumes, cover letters, and proceed to wait for about a week, hear absolutely nothing. And so I figure, well, you know, if it's been a week, that's fine. I'll call. So I try and get a hold of the hiring supervisors who'd be in charge of calling people and giving heads up about interviews, and I couldn't get through to anybody.
After waiting nearly a month for a response, the 21-year-old Boyer applied to his lower-wage backups, only this time, it was online and totally impersonal.
I didn't even get to wear a suit. I was in my pajamas.
Best Buy called the next day, and Boyer is now set to work at the new electronics store in East Anchorage. It's a job he's willing to take, but not one he's ecstatic over. He's probably not alone. As more experienced adults now look for employment outside of their trained fields, it may limit the jobs available to young people. Princess Tours Vice President of Community and Public Affairs, Bruce Bustamante, says that they've seen an increase in the amount of applicants with more experience.
The trend that we saw in hiring for the 2009 summer season was a higher number of applicants that really had a lot of experience, more from managerial positions and such, and really, which was really an indication of, you know, people that had been displaced.
According to a state report on young workers in Alaska, 15% of Alaska's workforce is between the ages of 14 to 21. They are employed mostly in retail and food service industries and earned more than $408 million in 2007. But Alaska is starting to feel the crunch of the global economic crisis. Alaska's unemployment rate fell to 8% in April, but is up 1.4% from last year. Rob Krieger says that the number of youth working have remained historically consistent, but he speculates that possible declines in industries like tourism could cause a drop in employment.
You know, that's the type of thing, that we really don't know what's going to happen in some of those industries at this point, so it's kind of tough to say. But obviously, if there were declines, and I would think that it would probably impact, you know, employers' tendency or ability to hire.
Krieger is a state economist who co-authored the report on youth workers in Alaska. He says that they won't know if there will be a decrease in youth jobs this summer until the data is compiled.
It's something that we would definitely be able to see, you know, a year from now when we actually get the data where we can analyze it. But it would be tough to make a forecast on that.
Boyer still has a few years before he graduates and has to find serious employment. But he's starting to worry, not because of this summer's job hunt, but because of larger struggles he sees with other people his age.
A friend of mine who's going into his fourth year, and he was trying to get an internship for his fourth year. And he went up to everyone and you know, he's talking to them, saying who else has been applying, you know. And everyone applying for these fourth year college internships that aren't paying are college graduates. You know, they're done, and they're taking all of the fourth-year internships, so the third years have nothing to do.
But Boyer says even with the struggles, he's not going to wait around for things to change.
We don't have the luxury of being able to, you know, sit around and say, oh, man, the world sucks, doesn't it? No, we have to say, oh, God, the world sucks, and we need a job because we're going to be living on the street.
In Anchorage, I'm Susanna Caldwell.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com.
The Alaska Intertribal Council is meeting with tribal leaders and leaders from Alaska Native corporations in Anchorage over the next 3 days to address a myriad of ongoing concerns for Alaska Natives. Mike Williams is the AITC chairman and a regional vice president for the National Congress of American Indians. Williams says after 30 years, it may be time to re-examine the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act with an eye toward revising policies within ANCSA.
So we're starting today, and hopefully that we'll begin to start addressing some of the concerns that people have in terms of losing their subsistence hunting and fishing rights and the erosion of tribal sovereignty in Alaska.
William says an example is the fact that his five kids and four grandkids who were born after 1971 have no land rights within the regional or village corporations. He says he will have to divide his corporation shares between them, and he wants them to have the same benefits that he has.
And that they have full shares in our structures, and also to restore hunting fishing rights in that ANCSA, so we wouldn't have to live with or deal with the ANILCA Title VIII and the Federal Subsistence Board now. The hunting and fishing right that we have is very special to us, and I think that's front and center of our discussions today.
Williams says at the time ANCSA was passed, there was a thought that replicating the reservation system that exists for tribes in the lower 48 was a bad idea. But he said a land base for Alaska tribes is important for the future.
Because the population is going to increase in hub areas, and like Bethel and Kotzebue and, you know, Nome and other hub areas are not going to qualify for subsistence priority.
He says other concerns include suicide, crime, and domestic violence in village families.
Because the state of Alaska has limited capacity, and there's 80 communities, 70, 80 communities without any police protection right now.
The meetings will continue through Thursday. Homer author Dan Coyle's newest book is called The Talent Code. It springs from his search to understand how people learn to excel in a variety of skills. KBBI's Marsha Lynn spoke with Coyle and reports on what he discovered.
Coyle is a seasoned journalist, sports enthusiast, and former writer for Outside Magazine. He says a tennis phenomenon inspired his newest work.
This book really started with me noticing a strange fact, which was that a huge number of top tennis players came from the same club. And when I looked into it, it was this tiny, tiny club. They only had one indoor court, actually, and it was in Moscow, right? Now, there aren't that many tennis players that come out of those freezing parts of the world, but this club somehow was able to produce more top 20 women players than the entire U.S.
Coyle went to Moscow and then expanded his search.
Well, there was this little pop music studio in Dallas that was kind of doing the exact same thing. It wasn't big. It was using local kids. It wasn't importing them from Los Angeles or anywhere, but they were producing all these American idols. And then, sure enough, in classical music, there's this place over here where, well, Yo-Yo Ma went there. Itzhak Perlman was developed there. All these incredible players are coming out of these little bitty places.
His travels took him around the U.S. and abroad, including soccer fields in Brazil and baseball fields in the Caribbean. He identified what he calls talent hotbeds and patterns of learning.
There's certain types of practice when you're operating right at the edge of your ability that are amazingly fruitful. You acquire skill really, really fast if you're operating right on the edge and making mistakes and fixing them. And that act, which I'm calling deep practice, that zone, allows you to do some amazing things. And it's what I see in these talent hotbeds.
Coyle says coaches and teachers play a major role.
These places tend to spring up around these teachers. It's the teachers that are really sort of the asset, you know, the key part of this. And we see that in our own town of Homer, when we see these people around which tremendous amounts of talent have gathered itself, has grown, really.
Coyle is the father of four children, ages 7 to 13, and he's also been a coach. He says it's fascinating to see what interests kids and how to encourage them. People get discouraged from trying to do new things, thinking they don't have natural talent in certain areas. But Coyle says it's important to realize that skills can be acquired, and he cites the example of one well-known dancer.
If you think of talent as being magically in your DNA, then you absolutely wouldn't want to do that. But if you think of it as a circuit that you can build, and if you can see how you're growing that circuit, then you actually are kind of inspired to do it. And no matter who you are, Fred Astaire looked awesome on the finished product, but anybody who's read about him knows that it was all about him, you know, essentially having bloody feet because he practiced so intensely and so much and was such a perfectionist.
Coyle trekked 50,000 miles around the globe doing research for the Talent Code. He also studied the science behind how we learn and says it sends a positive message.
It's not as romantic to think of its skill in that way. It's very romantic to think of a baby who's born with his magic ability. That's an irresistible story. But I think we're entering this sort of new moment where we see it for what it is, which is there is this mechanism. Just like you can train to, you know, maximize your cardiovascular system, there's also a way to train and to sort of acquire skill at the highest velocity you can.
Coyle says he's gotten a lot of good feedback on his new book, especially from teachers in the community. This is his fourth book. In Homer, I'm Marsha Lynn.
How did a Haynes attraction join the ranks of Stonehenge, the Roman Colosseum, and the Great Wall of China? From KHNS, Tara Bicknell has the story.
A 19-foot, 8-inch tall hammer that stands in front of Main Street's Hammer Museum in Haynes is now part of an online ad campaign for a new granola bar that celebrates a world of big things. Dave Paul is founder and owner of the Hammer Museum. He's also the brains behind the gigantic hammer, which is made from a spruce tree, fiberglass, and some styrofoam.
Well, it started with an email from an ad agency in New York who said they were interested in using the big hammer there in Haynes for their Big Nut Bar ad campaign.
The Haynes Museum already has worldwide connections. The oldest hammer among its collection of more than 1,500 hammers comes from Egypt and dates back to 2500 BC. Museum staff says it could have been used to help build the Great Pyramid, which also made the Big Nuts list.
We're actually in pretty good company here, and it really shows the different cultures between North America and Europe. For instance, the company that the big hammer had in North America was a giant chainsaw, an 11-foot-tall motorcycle. In Europe, they feature Stonehenge, and in Asia, there's the Great Wall of China.
Paul says the inspiration to build the colossal hand tool was not to compete with the Taj Mahal, just to get a little attention.
You know, we had people just walking down the street really not paying much attention to us, and the big hammer seems to grab their attention.
Paul says he's still waiting to try the Big Nut Bar. After all, it helped put his big hammer on the map. Or maybe it's the other way around.
It'd be nice if they'd send us a case of Big Nut Bars that we can hand out, I guess. You'll notice on the ad it says that the creator of the big hammer deserves a Big Nut Bar. I'm still waiting. I guess it kind of makes you wonder who the big nut really is.
Reporting from member station KHNS, I'm Tara Bicknell in Haynes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly and Marsha Lynn in Homer, Ben Stanton in Seward, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Tara Bicknell in Haynes. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Susanna Caldwell from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. The Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And by
the UAF College of Engineering and Mines, providing early registration for fall engineering classes at 1-877-474-7390. Information at uaf.edu/cem.
Sooner or later, the H1N1 swine flu will come to Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water, or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay at home if you're sick and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.